This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivisodi. It's a Friday. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me. How are you today, George?
Excited.
I mean, you ought to be. I mean, it's Movember.
It is Movember. And also, I'm wearing a blue ribbon, not in aid of Movember, but in aid of something else. And also, you know, it's Friday. Tomorrow is a public holidays and it's not raining. It's a good day to be happy.
Right. I see some facial hair happening on your face. You've attempted this over many years,
gosh,
George.
There's a lot of vinegars rubbed on my face to get the hair growing, but it's not doing well.
I'm very proud that you even tried. You know? You're the wrong race, but never mind.
I know. Well, there's always that attempt for, you know, budak cina to try.
Okay, I didn't say it, you did. All right, so it happens to be Lung Cancer Awareness Month as well. In November. And so today we're discussing supporting lung cancer patients. In the studio with us, Dr. Anand Sachidanandan, a consultant cardiothoracic surgeon, and Dr. Toh Laiman, a consultant oncologist. Mm-hmm. And both these gentlemen are the founders of Lung Cancer Network Malaysia. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. How are you today?
Very well, Meera. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about Lung Cancer Network Malaysia. What made you want to start an organization like this? It's an NGO, am I correct?
That's right. Mm-hmm. So LCNM basically is an NGO, and the reason the whole idea was conceived about a year ago, initially informal discussions, just, you know, born out of frustration, really, because in Malaysia, which is similar to global trends, the vast majority of cases of lung cancer picked up too late. As I'm sure we all appreciate, lung cancer, like most cancers, there are four stages to the disease.
Of course.
And in Malaysia, about 90% of cases, the most contemporary data we have suggests, local data suggests, that 9 out of 10 cases, 90% of cases, are being detected, being diagnosed in stages 3 and 4.
Shocking.
It is shocking, George. And I think automatically we're out of the game. You know, the whole treatment intent is largely palliative. Despite advances in chemo and radio and immunotherapy, these treatments are not curative. So I think the awareness of the disease is very, very low, not just within society at large, but even among the medical profession, with our colleagues in general practice in primary healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the principal reasons we wanted to set up this NGO, to raise awareness, both amongst the Malaysian public at large, as well as primary care as well.
Dr. Toh, do you think it's a lack of awareness that we are picking up lung cancer in stages 3 and 4? And mind you, this is pretty much across most cancers in Malaysia. It is picked up at a much later stage, except for, you know, the treatment options for lung cancer seems to be rather limited. The prognosis seems to be a lot worse compared to the others. But Dr. Toh, do you think it's a lack of awareness or are we in denial?
Well, absolutely. I think it partly is due to the difficulty in picking up lung cancer at an early stage, but coupled with the fact that screening has not really been promoted in lung cancer, although the evidence is now strongly supportive of this approach. But I think just to echo what Dr. Anand has said, lung cancer kills more people than colon, breast and prostate cancer combined. So even though, you know, the burden of disease is high, the mortality rate extremely high, lung cancer is also a disease of Asians. 60% of lung cancer occurs in East Asia and Southeast Asia. So globally, out of the 2 million cases, 1.2 million cases occurs in this region. So it's particularly relevant to our population.
Why? Why us?
Good question. I mean, smoking has a big part to do with the etiology of lung cancer. 70% of cases are associated with smokers. However, on the opposite side, 30% occur in non-smokers. Anecdotally, in my patient population, 50% of people are not smokers. And this is potentially to do with other environmental factors such as pollution, and also perhaps wok frying in Chinese women.
Yes, I mean, I love that analogy of wok frying. I mean, when you shared it for the first time with us, Dr. Toh, I was really quite, I was quite surprised. I mean, how much of wok frying can you, how much of that can you link to lung cancer? How would we know it's actually the wok frying?
So when I first looked at the data, I was pretty surprised myself. You know, in fact, there's a meta-analysis being published now of 20-something studies linking wok frying, the products of the actual cooking process, the high heat causing perhaps chemical changes in the food, linking that to the occurrence of lung cancer in women especially. So in Singapore, the statistics are about 30% of cancer occurs in non-smoking. Even the American Cancer Society quotes a figure of 20%. And there are pockets of these occurrences in places like downtown New York, Chinatown, etc.
But those are the minority of the people presented to presented with lung cancer. Is that correct in my kind of perception?
Yeah, it's actually 20 to 30% official figures.
Oh, right. Amongst
practice,
women or just across the board?
About two-thirds of these are women,
okay.
But also probably about a quarter to a third are actually men.
Right.
So
I just want to give the Char Kway Teow guy a mask or something. I mean, isn't that a danger? I mean, isn't that an occupational hazard then?
I think, George, your point is very pertinent, and it highlights part of the issue of perception.
That's right.
Because what we were all taught in medical school, you know, the link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer, it's been established for almost half a century, or over half a century, by two British epidemiologists, right, in the mid-1950s. And that's what we were taught. It's a disease of smokers. Mm-hmm. The majority of smokers are usually men. So we associate it to be a male smoker's disease. But as what Dr. Tho is saying, we're now seeing not just in our own practices anecdotally, but in the region, 25, 30, 40% of cases are in non-smokers, predominantly in women.
Right.
Various etiologies or causations for this. But I suspect whilst wok frying is clearly one of the risk factors, if you do high-temperature Chinese-style wok cooking in a poorly ventilated environment, you don't have the extractor fan, the fume extractor, that's a risk factor. But I suspect there are many cases of lung cancer in the so-called non- or never-smoker, but it's actually inadvertent second-hand or third-hand smoking, passive smoking. Mm-hmm. So they may have had a cumulative chronic exposure to passive smoking, either from a spouse or in the work environment as well. And We that's one of the goals of us, of this NGO, is to try and educate people that we shouldn't be complacent. It's an erroneous belief to think that lung cancer is only a disease of smokers.
And it creeps up on you later on, isn't it?
Very much so, Mira, because I think this is the point, you know, it's very elusive. In the early stages of the disease, as with most cancers, there are very few signs and symptoms.
And I mean, you highlighted in the beginning of the program that 90% of the sufferers presented late. I mean, comparatively with advanced countries, what are we talking about? What are we aspiring to?
Sure. Okay. So if we look at a very developed economy or healthcare system like the UK, we're all familiar with that. Their stats would suggest that at diagnosis in the UK today, still around 70 to 75% will be picked up late in stages 3 and 4. So they're not doing particularly well either.
That's right. But, so I'm trying to highlight here, you know, what are we trying to be aware of? Is it just the walks or is it just smoking cessations? I mean, I find it difficult to believe, you know, half a century later, we still have ignorance about causations, effect of smoking and pollutions, you know, contributing to lung cancer. One of the perceptions about lung cancer, it is that it's a depressing disease because of two things. Number one, it's aggressive. The latent period is very short. When you get diagnosis, then you have a very short time of achieving that curative intervention. The second problem is that the screening tools are very ineffective and not very efficient in picking up the early stage lung cancer. Is that wrong perceptions in the 21st century?
I think the second comment, George, if I can just briefly say it, that is incorrect in so much as we have the technology. When I say we, across the world, low dose CT scans, computed tomography. Yeah, that imaging modality is available, widely available in Malaysia in the public and private healthcare sectors. And there are two major trials. One is the National Lung Screening Trial, which came out of the US, and that was published in the New England Journal, a very reputable medical journal, way back in 2011. Mm-hmm. And that provided unequivocal evidence that screening of a high-risk population, which was defined at that time point as men of a certain age group, 55 to 80 years of age, with a certain smoking history, that there was a clear survival benefit, mortality, death risk reduction. A more contemporary study is called the Nelson study, which was published. It's a European study that's come out of the Netherlands and Belgium. And the results were reported last year at the World Conference on Lung Cancer. And that has reaffirmed the American study. In fact, they've gone one step further. The results are very impressive, that there's a 26% mortality reduction for men at 10 years. And in a smaller subgroup of women, compared to the American study, the Europeans included women in the trial, there can be a risk reduction in death as high as 62%.
Mm. So at what stage, though?
This would be to pick up the disease early. It's a screening program, Mira.
Okay.
So we have the evidence. We have the technology available. The challenge for all of us collectively, and this is one of the goals of LCNM, is to try and advocate and promote screening with a low-dose CT scan, but in a very ethical, responsible way that is underpinned by science. And in fact, in that regard, we have actually collaborated in conjunction with Lung Cancer Awareness Month this November. We are collaborating with seven major hospitals, six in the Klang Valley and one outside. We have managed to collaborate with them to offer free low-dose CT scans to persons deemed to be at high risk.
Dr. Toh, who should do these screening tests?
So we are offering it to people who are 45 to 75 years old, who have a smoking history of a 20-pack year smoking history.
20-pack a day?
20-pack, yeah.
20-pack?
So if you smoke a pack a day for a year, that's 1-pack year. So if you smoke two packs a day.
Packs a day.
I was like, no way. You'll be dead in like 2 years.
You're trying to sleep if you smoke 20 packs a day. So, two packs a day for a year is 2-pack years. So 20-pack years. So you could,
Okay. And how will we make this cost effective? I mean, it's free at the moment, as Dr. Anand had mentioned. But will that be effective, or will it be cost effective across the country?
It's not as cost effective as breast cancer screening, for example, using mammography and ultrasounds. But if you target the appropriate population, then potentially it will become cost effective. I suppose the cost effective studies are still underway, but we know the technology works to pick up cancers early and to improve survival.
And if you say,
but I just want to go back to your comment a bit earlier on, and George as well. No, just to say that lung cancer as a field, even though we may treat patients at stage 3 and 4 predominantly, the survival has improved by leaps and bounds over the last couple of years, especially to do with the introduction of immunotherapy and targeted therapy, which we could, you know,
we'll discuss later. So you said 45 to 75, depending on how many packs a year, whatever. What if you're a non-smoker? As you said, there are quite a number of people now who are non-smokers. Yeah. So how, you know, who should be screening then?
I think, I mean, Mira, you've hit the nail on the head. That is the Achilles heel with screening at the moment, because we have to, we can only advocate where there's evidence and science. And at the moment, we have compelling evidence, scientific data worldwide, that you can the high-risk group who will benefit from screening are smokers of a certain duration, men and women, and in a certain age group. So what we have done is we've tweaked that a little bit, taking into account local epidemiology, life expectancy, the age standardized incidence rate of lung cancer, et cetera, for Malaysia. And that's the parameters, 45 to 75. The challenge and difficulty is how to pick up that unfortunate group of the non-smokers, many of whom are women. And at the moment, we don't have strong evidence to advocate screening.
Is there any
group
indication to look for the walk friars now in order to screen them?
Well, George, I mean,
could well be.
That comment is, I think, is very, very pertinent, because I think a lot of this research is European-based, and we really need Asian-based studies to look at this. At this particular population.
I mean, with Singapore coming with so many publications associated with walk fryings, are they not in the forefront of trying to pick up these ladies who are exposed?
Actually, I was at a conference in Singapore at the start of the year, and I think I can't recall the name of the study, but they are going to carry out a community-based screening program targeting precisely what you've said, the non-smoker, the women.
So watch this space.
I mean, does it matter whether it's gas or you're using, you know, firewood? I mean, this is just me going into, you know, details. So what is it about wok frying that's triggering lung cancer?
It's probably the high temperatures at which the food is cooked. So the temperature causing carcinogenic changes in the food.
Mm-hmm. Will that food be causing potential lung cancer in the consumer as well? You know, people who eat the food?
Yes, yes. So there are studies.
The cook and also the people who eat the food?
Yes, correct.
Is this something that's happening suddenly now? Because, I mean, most of Chinese cooking is, you know,
centuries.
Yeah. Why is it just happening now?
I think, like most things, we're just getting better at detecting diseases now. So it comes to the fore, you know. It's probably as old as the hills, as you say.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Mira, I mean, we've done numerous cancer shows on screening and that sort of thing. One of the issues that, obviously, I'm very impressed that we are giving low dose radiations to patients to detect on the first come, kind of like a several numbers that will get this free screening. My concerns are in twofold. Hopefully, you can clarify a little bit. Number one is, how often do we screen patients in order to make it effective to pick up cancer? I think that will be a very important challenge, because for the people who get the first clearance, what does it mean in terms of effectiveness or accuracy of that screening? And the second thing is, what sort of radiation should people worry about? Obviously, too much radiations can itself induce cancer. And then so how should we go forward with that sort of like 2 points?
Okay, we'll come back and find out more up next. We're discussing lung cancer. If you have a question for us, give us a call. The number is 7732900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, it is Lung Cancer Awareness Month, and the Lung Cancer Network Malaysia, which has just been formed, an NGO, they've got a awareness tag it contest. And if you take a picture with a little flower pot or a plant, which, you know, the four of us did just now, just look out for that space. Tag LCN Malaysia and upload it either on Instagram or Facebook and, support this fight against lung cancer. So once again, if you have a question, give us a call. All of that coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's our Doctor in the House series, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist.
Breathing freely.
Yeah. that was pretty apt, wasn't it? Joining us also while we're discussing lung cancer, supporting lung cancer patients this Lung Cancer Awareness Month, Dr. Anand Sachidanandan, a consultant cardiothoracic surgeon, Dr. Tolai Man, a consultant oncologist. And, you know, before we left off, I spoke to you about how the Lung Cancer Network Malaysia has an awareness tag it contest. So once again, take a photograph of yourself with a potted plant or, you know, something green, post it on Instagram or Facebook, tag LCN Malaysia and, you know, support this fight against lung cancer. Now, we've got some interesting questions. Now, I think you've got the wok frying going with many people. We've got a question here. If wok frying is attributed to lung cancer, then China should rightly have a higher incidence of the disease in the world. And this is coming from Michael. What do you think?
I think so, like what we spoke about, the 60% of the world's lung cancer occurs in Asia.
Oh.
So potentially, there may be an association there. Mm-hmm. But having said that, there's a very high incidence of smoking
in China
as well.
Right. Mm. So you can't really tell whether it's the wok frying.
I think whenever we talk about etiology, it's sometimes difficult to tease out the exact reason a person develops a particular disease.
Yeah.
I mean, we can only do associative studies.
Mm-hmm. So is it fair to say China has got the highest rate of lung cancer in the world?
I can't recall the actual statistics offhand, but I think it's amongst, if not one of the highest in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's probably a triple whammy because, as Dr. Tho was saying, firstly, obviously, there'll be a higher proportion of wok frying Chinese high-temperature wok cooking. Air pollution, we know the air quality, there's the perennial haze effectively in China.
Yes.
And the actual incidence of smoking is also quite high.
Of course.
And they have some of the youngest patients or victims of lung cancer that have been documented.
That is triple whammy.
Mm-hmm. And genetics as well, probably the quadruple.
Yes.
Really?
Well,
right,
George,
yeah. That's right, yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. Another comment from Maggie, and she's saying, our Chinese forefathers took herbal drinks to balance the heat in our bodies.
Yeah, it's too
heaty. Modern Chinese rarely take herbal drinks. Seriously, come on, Dr. Toh,
so
George.
I've got this one.
Yeah.
So, not infrequently, my Chinese patients will come to me and say, oh, look, you know, in China, we've got all these herbal medications which prolong life. And what do we have to learn from Western medicine. So I showed them a graph of the life expectancy in China. Uh-huh. So in the 60s, in the 50s, it was around about 50 years old, 60 old. Mm-hmm. And right now, it's probably about 70 over. Mm-hmm. And back in the 1940s, it was probably less than 50. Mm-hmm. So the average life expectancy in China has really shot up with the introduction of Western medicine. So that's my my answer to my patients.
Counter argument to the herbal tea.
So it's not the heatiness, right?
It's a herbal tea.
Countering arguments with facts, probably.
Yeah.
Okay. Another question from Chow Tai He. Chow is saying high heat cooking is if high heat cooking is the culprit. What about roasting and baking and barbecuing?
I think it's probably the same thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you burn a piece of meat till it's sort of with the black.
I mean, most people associate barbecue with Australians. How are we doing, seeing the Australians with the epidemiology of lung cancer?
Not quite familiar with Australian epidemiology.
Again, I couldn't give you the exact.
That's a bit, probably a bit of stereotyping of Australians with barbecue, right? Mm.
But it's a question of how often do you do it as
of
well.
Course,
like, what frying you tend to do it
on
more
a daily
often
basis,
than,
perhaps. Yeah.
I think the other thing is, as we said, the etiology or causation of most diseases, including lung cancer, often multifactorial, isn't it? So there are many factors at play, your genetic predisposition and then environmental or dietary factors
indeed.
As well.
So the way I look at it, all of us are exposed to these risks. I mean, walk frying aside, pollution, smoking, whether you are secondhand, inhaled, passive smokers. And what was the other one? Two of it are being...
Pollution.
Yes, that's right. Those are some of the main things that are contributing towards lung cancer, even in this country. So none of us are really spared from this, are we?
No. Okay.
Goodness. Right. You mentioned about screening, and George had two questions. How often do we screen, and what about the radiation? Can we answer that question?
Maybe we take the second one first.
Of course.
This is a question we are frequently asked in the clinics when we tell patients. Obviously, I would be seeing patients who require surgery. They've been confirmed to have lung cancer, usually earlier stage disease. And we do a CT or a PET scan as a surveillance to monitor for disease recurrence. And there's always this concern and anxiety about the radiation, but we're actually on the threshold of ultra-low dose CT scanners. Mm. And even the low-dose CT scanner, which is probably for the benefit of the listeners, is different from a conventional contrast CT in that it does what it says. Mm-hmm. It's a low radiation dose. The patient or person can walk in. They don't need to fast. They don't need to do a blood test to check their kidney status. Mm-hmm. The radiological quantification of the radiation dose, it's very low, 1 to 2.5 millisieverts, which is... In the modern CT scanners, it's only a little bit more than a conventional chest X-ray.
Mm-hmm. And then do you have any idea, most people compare this to the natural radiation you expose on a trip to London,
remember
right?
Remember we had those, radiologists who said that one X-ray is equivalent to a trip to London.
Right, in the plane. Do you have any idea how many trips would that be, or how many chest X-ray would that be equivalent to?
Trips to London, I couldn't say with absolute certainty. I think with the modern low-dose CT scanners, it correlates to about 20, anywhere from 15 to 25 conventional chest X-rays. Mm-hmm. Sounds a lot, but I can assure you that in comparison to historical CT scans, it's considerably better.
Yes.
And probably it's very palatable when we look at our background radiation.
Okay.
Bear in mind, we recommend screening only for the high-risk group.
Yes,
they require that surveillance.
Yeah. And Dr. Toh, how often, according to the studies, are we doing it to pick up the lung cancers? How what's the interval?
So again, that's a very, very pertinent question. Maybe if I can just take a minute to answer that. If we could take a step back, when a person goes for screening, as we know, the concept is to pick up the disease before you have symptoms and you're deemed to be at higher risk of getting the disease, in this case, lung cancer, there can be only one of three outcomes. You can have a perfectly normal scan, which will be in the majority of people. Mm-hmm. And that's a point where, that's a time point when we can advocate to the person to stop smoking if they are a smoker.
Of course.
A bit of counseling. There is no guarantee they will not go on to develop a cancer in the future. They could have an obvious lesion, and the data suggests that if we target appropriately, about 2 to 3%, that's the pickup rate. Mm-hmm. You'll pick up an early stage cancer, and they should be appropriately investigated and treated accordingly. The difficulty is that intermediate group, where they don't have a completely normal scan, and there's nothing that's seemingly obvious to be a cancer, what we call as an indeterminate pulmonary nodule. Mm-hmm. And here's where the patient will need a period of surveillance. we try to correlate the radiological, the appearance on the CT scan with the clinical profile, depending on their risk profile. And it's sort of individualized depending on the individual patient. It could range from anywhere from 3 to 4 to 6 months of follow-up scan. Now, if someone has a completely normal scan, then the surveillance would probably be, well, I can tell you in US, in the American guidelines, they're quite aggressive and they advocate annual screening until the age of 80 or until that person develops a condition that is prohibitive for them to get definitive treatment, be it surgery or chemo or radiotherapy.
Your view on that, of Malaysian population getting CT scan yearly?
Yeah, I think that's very American. I think we tend to be a bit more judicious and a bit more cautious here. I mean, we live in the real world. There's a whole cost issue as well. So part of the aim is to raise awareness. I think we need to have sufficient resources, not just financially, but the relevant specialists to address the issue.
But do you think people will come forward?
Well, we hope so, Mira. But
the reason I ask is because mammograms are free in government hospitals and the take-up rate is so low. I mean, lung cancer, I mean, smokers are not going to come forward.
Sure. But if you're starting from zero, close to zero, then I think...
you have nothing to lose.
You've only way but up.
That's it.
Okay.
All right.
So that's why you got to sell... and we have a question here. Please confirm whether acrylamide causes lung cancer. This is from Shah.
That sounds pretty carcinogenic.
Acrylamide.
I'll go with a yes.
So I think there's some association with bladder cancer, actually, acrylamide. It's used in dyes, the colouring industry.
George, that's your area.
I know. So I make myself some relevance tonight, today. Right,
yes. Okay. Indoor pollution.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Dr. Toh, how do you talk to your patients about the prognosis of advanced stage lung cancer? Because if you're detecting 90% of these people, you know, at third and fourth stage, how do you even have that conversation?
The conversation would be quite difficult and potentially very short, maybe 10 or 20 years ago. So the expected 5-year survival rate for lung cancer, even just going back 10 or 20 years ago, was less than 5%, at 5 years. However, things have changed considerably. So whenever we see a patient now, we stratify them according to the genetics that the cancer possesses. So we do a genetic profile of the cancer, and in some cases, we're expecting patients to survive at least 5 years, if not more. So we've got, and that's largely down to the treatments that we have, which are targeted therapies and immunotherapies. Immunotherapy has been in play for the last perhaps 5 years, and we're just getting the 5-year survival data, and it's about 25% of patients that will survive to 5 years. For someone with an ALK-positive mutation in the cancer, suitable for targeted therapy, we expect them to survive at least 4 to 5 years, if not more. We've got survivors at 8 years, 10 years.
Okay, is this in combination with Anand's effort in terms of like removal of the primary plus also the immunotherapy?
No, this is just systemic therapy, so no surgery. Surgery is reserved for patients who are at stage 1 or 2 and some at stage 3. So what I'm talking about is inoperable patients.
Okay, we'll come back to immunotherapy and targeted therapies. But LTY has a question for us. LTY, how are you today?
Good afternoon, Mira.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, and happy Deepavali.
Thank you very much. We're heading into Christmas now.
Good afternoon, Dr. George.
Hello.
To our guest doctors. Okay. Good afternoon to you all. Okay, my question is this. Is there any gene that protects from lung cancer, whether you are a smoker or non-smoker?
Great question.
My second question is about house cooking. House cooking at high temperature is very dangerous because why? It causes oxidation, polymerization, and chemical changes which can lead to carcinogenic or mutagenic agent coming into play.
Okay. Now, thank you.
Doctor, thank you.
I'm 76 years old. I've been smoking for
Okay, LTY, thank you very much. Okay, we have the next. We'll come back to LTY's question. One is gene, if there is a gene, and then house cooking, right? We'll come back. Yong has a question. Yong, you're on the line.
Afternoon, Yong.
Yeah, afternoon, Dr. George and Mira. And, how to guess?
Good afternoon, Yong. How are you today?
Okay, fine. So earlier it was mentioned colouring is one of the cancer causing. So where is this colouring found? Is it in packaged food or anywhere else?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very
much. We'll take the call later.
Did we talk about colouring by chance?
Acrylamide.
Yeah. Okay, so it was okay. in that context.
Yeah, majority of these are studies that actually showed that the dye can be potentially carcinogenic for lungs and bladder, and there are multiple studies to associate them. But majority of these dyed actually had been removed. So we're not talking about food colouring or anything like that. Mm. We're talking about industrial colourings. Yeah. Let's come back to LTY's questions, genetics basis of lung cancer.
So genetics is a field that's really exploded over the last 5 or 10 years. We have to differentiate between germline genetics, so genetics which are gene mutations which are passed down from father and mother to children, versus somatic mutations. Somatic mutations being mutations in the tumour that's caused by environmental factors. So we know a lot about the latter. So we now have almost 20 genes that we test for in lung cancer at the outset to determine which is the best treatment for the patient that sees us in the clinic. But we don't know a lot about the germline mutations. So that is still a field of a lot of research is required. We don't have any clues as to why certain people or populations develop more cancer easily than others. Yeah.
I'm just curious, if we are exposed to the haze every year, like we usually do, how damaging is that?
Well, I suppose, in theory, if that was to be an annual event, you know, it's certainly something that is hazardous to the health. And I think if you have cumulative chronic exposure, then certainly that would, over a lifetime, be a risk factor for all sorts of lung diseases, including potential lung cancer. Mm-hmm. Because often a cancer can develop within damaged or scarred lung tissue. So, for example, if someone's had a history of pulmonary tuberculosis, they have an elevated risk of developing a lung cancer within that scarred lung tissue, a latent period maybe 15, 20, 30 years later. So by that sort of, if we extrapolate from that, if you had haze-induced lung injury, that, you know, in theory, that could predisposed lung cancer many years later.
We have evidence that pollution is linked to an increased incidence of lung cancer. I think that's reasonably well established. Mm-hmm. But again, which component of the pollution, which component of the air that is causing the cancer, that's unclear.
Subjective. Doesn't the lung sort of, during periods where, you know, pollution levels are lower, does the lung have time to sort of
recover?
Or it doesn't?
I think that... Go on, do you want to...
I'm sorry, what's the question?
Does the lung have time to recover?
No, I think lung damage, a lot of lung damage can be permanent. Mm. So acute lung injury, even though it recovers, can result in fibrosis, so scarring of the lung. And chronic inflammatory changes of the lung or any organ leads to cancer.
Yeah. While we're talking about culprits that's damaged a lung and potentially causes lung cancer, I mean, one hot topic at the moment is all the vapings and all these kind of like e-cigarettes. What's your view about correlations of those with cancer?
It's not all good.
I think, that's very topical at the moment. And in fact, I think it was a few weeks ago, there was a coalition of NGOs that met at the Malaysian Medical Association MMA House to lobby the government to push for legislation to ban vaping and all these heated tobacco-related products. Mm-hmm. The short answer is the jury's still out. We don't know.
Of course.
What I can share is that we know the Cleveland Clinic, which is one of the leading healthcare institutions in the world, they've published very recently, last month, a very small case series, the first in the world, of 8 patients. I think this is on the back of a lot of vape-related deaths in the United States. A small series of 8 patients who had acute lung injury, chronic vaping. And these patients had a lung biopsy. So a sample of lung tissue has been taken out and it has been examined under the microscope, what we call as histological evaluation. And they were able to demonstrate that there is a lot of changes at a cellular microscopic level, organizing pneumonia, diffuse alveolar damage. So I think this is one of the first studies that demonstrates that vaping is hazardous. Mm. And I think it's quite disingenuous for, you know, tobacco companies to you know, create the perception that it is a healthy alternative to smoking. In fact, it may well be the path into smoking as well. Mm-hmm. The truth is we don't know enough about it and the constituents that go into the vape or the heating devices.
Okay, we'll come back. We haven't gone through the immunotherapy and targeted therapy. Your thoughts on it, Dr. Anand. And, you know, Malaysian government has done well. We've got a smoking ban going, but we lack a standalone Tobacco Control Act. We'll come back and talk about some of these issues coming up next on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. If you have just joined us, it's our Doctor in the House series, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me. It means it's a Friday, George. We can go home very soon. Also joining us, Dr. Anand Sachidanandan, a consultant cardiothoracic surgeon, and Dr. Tolai Man, a consultant oncologist, both of whom are founders of the Lung Cancer Network Malaysia, which is a non-governmental association, organization which is, you know, championing more awareness and possibly even low-dose CT scans for improving the early detection of lung cancer, because 90% of Malaysians with lung cancer are detected at stage 3 and 4. We've spoken about some of the possible causes, or they are causes, of lung cancer. Can't say exactly which one is which, but smokers for sure. 70%, you were saying, of lung cancer patients are smokers. Those who are exposed to passive smoking also at risk. Pollution for sure. Wok frying came through, and that was a very interesting conversation. And your genes play a role. How, George, you can't control the genes. What are you going to do?
choose your parents wisely.
Yeah. I know, right? Can't do that, unfortunately. But something needs to trigger this gene to behave in the way it does as well, isn't it? Don't you think?
So I think the genes obviously interact with the environment, and the environmental factors you can control. Mm-hmm. So the smoking, the pollution, what you ingest, your lifestyle is an important factor as well. So being healthy and exercising and sleeping well, having a very stable home environment and emotional constitution, it probably plays a big part.
See, he's indirectly saying exactly what our neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina says. Eat healthy, exercise, and hug.
And hug. Yes. Hug a tree.
And love thyself.
Whatever, yeah, whoever, whatever. As long as it works for you.
Yeah, well, we need more trees to create more oxygen.
Absolutely.
That's right. And then, hence your potted plant campaign,
so,
right?
A shameless plug for LCNM. Okay, right.
Tell us more.
This is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. Trees and plants are the green lungs of the world. And we need healthy lungs and trees. So please hug a tree, take a selfie, tag us, hashtag LCN Malaysia.
Okay, I might win something.
You might win something.
Oh, really?
You might win an iPhone 11.
Whoa!
Pro. That's the top prize. Yes,
really?
Top prize, iPhone 11.
And you can do that on Facebook or you can do that on Instagram.
Oh, right. Oh, okay. That got us excited.
Hashtag LCN Malaysia. Do
That's
it right now.
Yeah.
We've done it already.
If you need an upgrade of your phone, you better do it now.
We were talking about immunotherapy and targeted therapy. When we always talk about these two in the context of cancer, cost becomes a huge factor. Now, how accessible are these options to lung cancer patients?
So Dr. Anand and I, in fact, recently attended a meeting at the Galen Centre to discuss social policy accessibility issues to do with lung cancer treatments. Probably beyond our pay grade to comment about, you know, accessibility in Malaysia. I think it's an issue throughout the world.
Mm.
Malaysia spends about 4% of its GDP on health.
Mm-hmm.
America spends, I think, about 4 times the amount, say 16%. Accessibility is an issue there as well as here.
Mm-hmm.
And people pay a lot of money in terms of insurance and in America.
Mm-hmm.
Which country which country do you think has done well? What about Australia?
I think they pay. I mean, Australia. Australia is a public funded system with some co-pay insurance. I mean, they've done okay, but in terms of accessibility, the best of the best in Malaysia get better treatment than in Australia, to be honest.
I mean, let's put things in perspective here. There are two groups of people who will need intervention. One group will see Dr. Anand, obviously, for surgery. These are the 10% who presented early. What sort of like journey will they look at in terms of their intervention and also cost?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, I think in the long run, it is cost-effective screening, picking up early-stage disease, because it's amenable to curative treatment. Mm-hmm. And often it's surgery, but often, as you know, George, it's part of multimodality. So surgery in combination with chemo, radio, immunotherapy.
Ah.
Sometimes that's delivered. It's a very exciting time in lung cancer management at the moment. So early-stage disease, if the patient is fit enough, if they agree for an operation, unequivocally, it's the gold standard. There's mm-hmm. no debate. It's the best chance to cure the patient. It's the best chance for long-term outcome. But we also look, once the tumor has been removed, as you know, we need to look at a lot of important parameters. The most important requisite is that the surgeon has removed the tumor completely, mm-hmm. what we call it an R0 resection. And we have to perform what is known as systematic lymph node dissection. And that helps to determine the post-operative, post-surgery pathological staging. Mm-hmm. On the basis of that, together with certain biological features which the pathologist will report on, mm-hmm. for instance, we call visceral pleural invasion and lymphovascular invasion, the patient may be upstaged and he or she may require some form of adjuvant treatment, which could be chemo, radio, immunotherapy.
That's when Dr. Thoe comes in.
That's when someone like Dr. Thoe would come in. And the whole point is to try and reduce the likelihood of recurrence, a local recurrence or a distant recurrence years later. And that's the basis of lung cancer management, that it's multimodal and a multidisciplinary approach. And that was one of the premises why we set up LCNM. We are disease-centric. We focus exclusively and solely on lung cancer. All our efforts, our resources, our activities is focused solely on lung cancer. And our group is unique. We hope it'll be impactful because we have the whole spectrum of medical and non-medical specialists. Mm. We recognize that optimal care requires a multidisciplinary, multimodality approach. In addition to all the relevant healthcare specialists, we also have non-doctors, allied health professionals, you know, physiotherapists, pharmacists, psychologists. We have yet to add dietitians. And so that we hope we are equipped to address all aspects of the of this disease.
Dr. Thoe, are you seeing younger patients?
Yes. In fact, Dr. Anand operated on a 20-something-year-old patient of mine just last
29.
two weeks ago. We are seeing the young presenting with lung cancer.
She was 29, Mira, just shy of her 30th birthday.
A woman, female.
So Dr. Thoe referred this. She's a very good illustration. She was an Oriental female. And it was an incidental finding, which means it was picked up by chance. She was newly married, applying for a job in Singapore. As part of the application process, she needed a screening x-ray. And it was picked up because the tumour was quite big. A non-smoker. Her dad never smoked. Her fiancé or new husband never smoked. No obvious family risk factor. So you would never screen and pick up such a person. And the tumour was quite big. So we discussed the case quite a bit. And she had some treatment. So this actually was a good illustration of targeted therapies.
So she wasn't operable at the outset.
That's right.
So we did her genetic profile, and we fortunately found a gene that was targetable by a tablet. So a simple tablet once mm-hmm. a day, and that shrunk the tumor by about 50-60%, which allowed Dr. Anand to go in and perform the operation and to potentially cure her.
So that was immunotherapy or target? What would you consider that? That was targeted
therapy, Mira. So yeah. Dr. Thoe was very meticulous in trying to map out. It's being a detective, as you know, with the preoperative biopsy, trying to profile. This is an illustration of precision medicine. We're in the area of personalized, you know, sort mm-hmm. of bespoke treatment. There isn't a one-size-fits-all anymore. And he was able to identify the genomic molecular mutation for this young lady. She had preoperative, or what we call as neoadjuvant targeted therapy. As Dr. Thoe said, it shrunk the tumour about 40-50%. It was still a very difficult operation, but it made it amenable to removing half of her left lung. We're delighted to say, thus far, she's doing well.
So targeted therapy first, and then surgery by yourself, Dr. Anand?
Yeah, so sometimes, Mira, sometimes the patient will get chemo, radio, immunotherapy before surgery. Mm-hmm. That would either be to shrink down the tumour and make it resectable, operable, or to irradiate the lymph nodes. And that is called preoperative downstaging. And occasionally they would need treatment afterwards, which is adjuvant therapy, after the definitive treatment, which in this case is surgery. So that again highlights the multimodality and multidisciplinary approach that is essential to provide optimal care.
In the era before genomic profiling, this patient would have had chemotherapy. and the chances of chemotherapy shrinking the tumour was only about 30 to 40%. However, with targeted therapy, we are expecting 80 to 90% chance of the tumour shrinking. As in this case, the tumour shrinking is critical in order to allow curative surgery to be performed.
Extraordinary.
Do you think insurance companies will eventually
give in?
Yes, to targeted therapy.
It's covered.
Oh.
All these are covered under the insurance. Immunotherapy, targeted therapy.
Okay.
What sort of outlook are you expecting patient like this?
So, as with all cancers, it's very much stage dependent. And we aim for what we set out for this young lady, and in most cases is obviously curative, you know, treatment with a curative intent. And the stage, which is the extent of spread of the tumour, any tumour, in this case lung cancer, is what determines, mm-hmm. As you know, George, the prognosis of the outcome.
Of course.
So that's quantified at a 5-year survival. I guess time will tell. If you look at the statistics, if you're early stage 1A, you would have a 5-year survival anywhere from 70 to 90%. That's sort of global data.
Yeah.
And it diminishes all the way to stage 4, less than 5% survival. But that's a bit of historical data, as Dr. Thor will be upset if I say that. But more contemporary data now in the era of immunotherapy, targeted therapies, he is frequently seeing patients with stage 4 disease living, you know, approaching 3-4 years and beyond. So we're getting patients to live longer, but it's also about quality of life as well. But late-stage disease is still non-curative. They will die from the cancer, not with the cancer.
Mm. Unlike your area, prostate cancer
is very different. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You die with prostate cancer.
Yeah.
So when does the discussion of palliative care come into play?
So the traditional approach of palliative care is to introduce that service when the oncologist has run out of ideas. But I think the more contemporary approach is to have co-management of the patient, to introduce our colleagues at an early stage to really develop the rapport, the familiarity, because palliative care physicians are excellent in terms of managing symptoms as well as looking at the overall patient, how mm-hmm. they cope at home and with their issues. So in my practice, I would love to have a palliative care physician work side by side with me and really walk through the journey with the patients.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you don't have that yet? I'm sure you do.
The service is patchy. I think some hospitals offer that service. Because I'm primarily based in a hospital, I think George has the opportunity to access one in his hospital.
Yeah, I mean, apart from that, Hospice Malaysia actually play a big role as well in helping the patients to do palliative care, especially in the community.
They provide an excellent service.
Yeah. They are fantastic, actually. Yeah. Okay, so we know that we've got a smoking ban. We lack a standalone Tobacco Control Act in Malaysia. All of which, you know, I'm sure we're working on. We're working to regulate vaping and, you know, all these heat and burn products. How much of it is policy? How much of it is us as individuals to prevent lung cancer in the first place? And how much of it is the environment? How much of control do we have over this disease?
I mean, I think kudos to the government because they have introduced legislation to increase more no smoke, more no smoking zones, smoke free zones. But I think when we just walk around, that momentum seems to be going a little bit.
Yes, it is.
You know, it is an educational ban. It hasn't been enforced in terms of a punitive fine. And I think the way you shape human behaviour, unfortunately, is you have to enforce it. So I think we have a lot of legislation in this country, but the enforcement sometimes is a bit lacking. And it's important because at the end of the day, we can talk about very advanced immuno and target therapies. We can talk about state-of-the-art screening for lung cancer, but still, in the majority of cases, smoking is a causative etiological risk factor. And it's a very identifiable and preventable risk factor. And certainly, if one chooses to smoke, that's your prerogative. But I think for people who don't smoke, they should have the right to eat and dine and be in a smoke-free environment. So I think the enforcement has to match the legislation that is there.
Dr. Toh, so should all of us go out and do a low, dose spiral CT scan for get screened for it?
I think follow the guidelines. If you fit in that particular risk category, then certainly present yourself for screening. It may save your life.
45 to 75?
Smoking 20 pack years.
20 packs.
Men or women.
But I think, men have the health-seeking behavior of men is slightly different from women. So we anticipate an uphill struggle with men seeking screening services.
Sound familiar, George? Yeah,
indeed. Mm.
Right. Okay. The other two groups outside the screening criteria who may benefit from screening for lung cancer would be those who have a first-degree relative. So you have a family history of premature lung cancer, first-degree relative, sibling, a parent, or those who have a personal history of cancer. Unfortunately, if you've had one cancer, then statistically you're at greater risk of the
Giorgio message.
Cancer. I think it's refreshing to hear that you guys doing great works to highlight that it's not doom and gloom for advancements in lung cancer treatment.
Absolutely.
I just hope I win my iPhone.
Yes, take that photograph with a plant, post it on your Facebook page or Instagram and hashtag LCN Malaysia. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us today. Dr. Anand Sachidanandan, consultant cardiothoracic surgeon, Dr. Tolai Man, consultant oncologist, and of course, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.